We're joined on the air right now by Tom Jensen, Director of Public Policy Polling. PublicPolicyPolling.com is their website for all of the latest numbers and a lot of new surveys of competitive House districts out this week, including one for the state of Wisconsin generally, which has been and will continue to be competitive. We've also got some numbers on gun safety measures, what people think about the different proposals that are being tossed around now nationwide. Tom, thanks for joining us here.
Hey, Aaron, good to be with you.
So let's start with the issue that everyone's talking about this week, which is gun safety, gun violence, and gun control. There are a bunch of different measures that are being proposed to address gun violence, particularly mass shootings, particularly in schools. Where do Americans stand on the gun control issue in general, and are there particular proposals that there's more support for than others?
Well, one thing I thought was particularly remarkable this week was Quinnipiac University did a poll on a variety of gun control issues, but on sort of the very lowest common denominator policy, which is just to put in universal background checks on gun sales, they found 97% to 2% support. And I'm not sure I've just about ever seen anything on a poll that had 97% support. I saw somebody made the good point on Twitter that if you polled on whether the sky was blue, it would be unlikely to get to 97% on that. And Lord knows in Southern Orange County, really couldn't get 97% to agree that the sky is blue. So that was pretty amazing to see that sort of universal support. They also polled on a ban on assault weapons, and they found 67 to 29 support for a ban on assault weapons. We did a poll this week in Florida where we asked voters there if they would support an amendment to the state constitution that would ban automatic and semi-automatic assault weapons and the bullets that they use. We found 64% support for that in Florida, where obviously these issues recently have hit home particularly close, only 30% opposition to that. So we see, as we've always seen, strong support for stuff like the background checks and waiting periods and stuff like that. But we're actually now seeing pretty strong support for just flat out banning assault weapons, too. And I think the support we're seeing for that is maybe on a different level than we've sort of seen in the past. So it'll be interesting to see how much those numbers hold as the events of last week get further and further away. There have been some indications that this time might be different, particularly because of the really impressive activism that the high school students have engaged in that has sort of kept the issue in the spotlight. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, say a little bit more about those indications. I know I've heard people say that we have actually seen some long-term movement in the last few years on gun control, as much as we think that the debate just keeps sort of recycling itself with everyone making the same arguments and no one changing their minds, that polls are actually showing people moving, Americans moving in a particular direction. And you mentioned the 97 to 2 on universal background checks. I don't think I've ever heard anything like that before, even on something as basic as that. So is there an indication that we have hit a tipping point with this?
Yeah, there's definitely some indications of that. One thing, for instance, is when you look at the sort of Google searches about gun control 8 days after last week's incident compared to like 8 days after Sandy Hook, the level of interest as sort of measured through those Google searches has stayed up this time around in a way that didn't happen even after Sandy Hook with the tragedy of so many small children being killed. Somebody did a comparison of what the front page of the New York Times looks like today compared to a comparable period after Sandy Hook, and guns were already out of the headlines by this point after Sandy Hook. They're still all over the New York Times now. You think about the town hall that CNN had last night. If you went on Twitter, all of political Twitter was talking about this CNN town hall on guns, again, a week after the shooting happened in Florida. So there's a variety of different indications that this is not just sort of fading away quickly the way that these shootings usually do. You think about, for instance, like the Las Vegas shooting. The afternoon of the Las Vegas shooting, Tom Petty died, and by Wednesday, there's more people talking about Tom Petty died than 50 people got murdered in Las Vegas. So I think that a big part of the piece when something like this happens is for the issue to stay in the headlines. even though it's a very different sort of issue, I think, you know, a good sort of comparison to it in North Carolina is HB2. The reason that HB2 was such a liability for Republicans and the reason they ended up feeling like they had to repeat it was it was the biggest story in the news in North Carolina for like 5 or 6 weeks. If it had just disappeared from the headlines after a week, nothing would have happened. But because it was so sustained, it really put the pressure on them to do something where otherwise they wouldn't have. And I think you're sort of seeing a similar dynamic to that right now with gun issues. And, you know, the big question is, yes, it's stayed in the headlines for eight days now. Can it actually sustain where it's going to be what we're talking about for weeks on end? That's the point at which I think something maybe really happened.
And I think that's a really good point. And I think it's all the more remarkable because you and I have talked, and I know people listening to this conversation, I'm sure we've all had the experience of feeling this way, that especially in the last couple of years with the presidential campaign and Trump's presidency being as chaotic as it's been, nothing has managed to sustain itself front and center in the news cycle for more than 24 hours. You think everyone's talking about something, and then Donald Trump sends out some ridiculous tweet and everyone's talking about that. But you're right. This has sustained itself for a long time.
Yeah, certainly on the curve of how long things are sustaining themselves. And also, you know, when Trump does do a crazy tweet the last few days, it's about this issue. Mm-hmm. So that helps to keep it in the headlines as well. If he wanted it to go away and not have to do anything about it, he could just stay quiet. But he's not.
Speaking with Tom Jensen, publicpolicypolling.com is PPP's website. Go there and get the latest numbers from all of their national and state level surveys. There's one I know that you just did involving competitive House district, U.S. House districts across the country, and where people in those districts stand as we start getting into midterm season with that 2018 election less than 9 months away. Where do people stand on those House districts now?
Well, we polled 14 House districts across the country, all of them held by Republicans currently. And Democrats were leading in 11 out of the 14 of these Republican-held districts that we polled. And I think a couple of the things that were particularly noteworthy, one of the districts we polled was in Kansas, and Democrats had a 2-point lead there. One of the districts that we polled was in Kentucky, and Democrats had a 1-point lead there. Places like Kansas and Kentucky clearly are not places that Democrats have been very competitive in recent vintage. So when you see House races really shaping up as toss-ups that maybe even lean slightly towards the Democrats in places like those, it really, I think, shows the extent of the playing field that Democrats have across the country this year. And there actually was a real-world example of that in Kentucky on Tuesday night that was pretty remarkable. We've talked about some of these special elections over the course of the last couple years and how Democrats often will outperform how Hillary did in a district by 15 or 20 points. There was a special House election in Kentucky. We were actually the pollster for one of the groups that was really involved in that race. It was in a district that Donald Trump won by 49 points, and the Democrat won on Tuesday night by 36 points. So forget about those 15 or 20-point shifts we've been talking about from the 2016 election. That district in Kentucky had an 85-point shift from the 2016 election. So Democrats are winning places where it's pretty absurd for them to be able to win. So the Kentucky and Kansas examples are good there. I think another interesting example of sort of the national dynamics that we got from these House polls was in Florida Congressional District 27, heavily Hispanic and especially Cuban district in South Florida. It's been represented by Ileana Rose-Lehtinen for a really long time. I think maybe the last time there was a Democrat in that seat was the 80s. She's retiring, and Democrats have a 15-point lead in the race to replace her, 54 to 39. So that's somewhere where I think it sort of just shows that even in Hispanic areas where Republicans have been able to be competitive in the past, things are just kind of falling apart for them. And then just a couple other quick ones from this batch of polls I thought was noteworthy. Michigan's 11th congressional district, sort of where we come near from in suburban Oakland County, hasn't had a Democrat representing it in a very long time. Democrats up 45 to 42 there in an open seat situation. And then in Washington's 8th congressional district, which is in suburban Seattle and is another suburban district Republicans have been able to hold on to a long time, that's an open seat. Democrats are leading there. So both that suburban Detroit and that suburban Seattle district, I think, show that even in some of these suburban areas where Republicans have been able to hold the seat for a really long time, you're seeing, because of the political climate, Republican incumbents retiring, and now it looks like Democrats are pretty decently positioned to win back some of those seats. So Hispanic, suburbia, and then even some of these places Democrats haven't been competitive in forever, like Kansas and Kentucky, all on the table for Democrats this year.
And I know there's kind of similar numbers out of Wisconsin too, right?
Yeah, we did a statewide poll in Wisconsin, and Scott Walker obviously won in 2010, survived the recall election in 2012, won again in 2014. So I think after losing to him three times, Democrats start to get in some mentality like, oh, we're just not going to be able to beat Scott Walker. We're not going to be able to win the Wisconsin governor's race. And we found on the poll we did in Wisconsin this week that Walker has only a 43% approval rating, 52% disapprove of him. It's almost identical to Trump there, who has a 44% approval, 52% disapproval. So it's true, yes, Wisconsin's Republicans won in Wisconsin in 2014. They won in Wisconsin in 2016. But now voters in the state don't like either Governor Scott Walker, who they elected in 14, or President Donald Trump, who they voted for in 16. And I think that means they are open to voting in a different way this year. So one thing that always happens in a wave year is you'll have politicians who are sort of viewed as being untouchable, which I think Walker is in some quarters. And what you often learn in these wave elections is that the politicians you thought were untouchable actually are not untouchable at all. And the party that has the momentum will be able to win some things that they haven't won in a long time.
PublicPolicyPolling.com is the website for more info on the latest national and state level numbers. Tom Jensen, thank you so much.
Thanks, Aaron. Take care.